Okay. After separating the different universes, the gigantic universal form of the Lord, Mahavishnu, came out of the causal ocean, the place of appearance for the first Purusha avatar, entered into each of the separate universes, desiring to lie on the created transcendental water, Garbhadak. So it's interesting, says he was desiring to lie on the created transcendental water. So he has his own motivations and relationships to the creation.
Wow.
Okay. So this is the 10th verse. And of course, Shukadeva Goswami is establishing that the real, you know, shelter, perspective, light, illumination, intelligence, by which we can have a proper relationship with the world and have nothing to fear and nobody to envy, is Srimad Bhagavatam. And now he's describing it includes 10 categories. 10 categories, and these will be discussed throughout the Bhagavatam. And the first is the creation of the elements from Mahavishnu. Then after that, Brahma manipulates those. And he creates the creators of universal affairs, the different planetary lords. And the different planetary lords then take charge of their domains. And the Manus give instructions for how to live here properly. And in the end, the whole thing winds back up, you know, into the body of Mahavishnu. And some living entities who take advantage of the transcendental sound, as we've been hearing, they get out of this confusing thing and they become Nitya Siddha again. And those who don't, well, they get, you know, they go back with their karma and go on hold for the creation of the next universe. So now Fani is coming down to this point of actually describing the details of this process. And through the chapter, through the end of the chapter, we're going to see how the thing is this one sequence after another, how the basically the rest of this chapter goes through discussing pretty much sarga, you know, creation of the elements and the virat root form like that, so on. So next slide, which is number 5. Let's go ahead here. And Prabhupada's purport. So here we put a little picture of Garuda with Vishnu and Shri and Bhu. In under Vishnu's embrace, on the back of Garuda, who's holding a snake in his claws. And Prabhupada says in the purport, after analysis of the living entities and the Supreme Lord, Paramatma, the independent source of all other living beings, Srila Sukadeva Goswami is now presenting the prime necessity for devotional service to the Lord, which is the only occupational business of all living entities. Next slide. Yeah. It's number number 5, 6. The Supreme Lord, Sri Krishna, in all his plenary portions and expansions of plenary portions, are non-different from one another, and thus the supreme independence is in each and every one of them. In order to prove this, Sukadeva Goswami, as promised to King Parikshit, describes herein the independence of the Purusha avatar, personality of Godhead, even in the sphere of the material creation. Such activities of the Lord are also transcendental, and therefore they are also lila, or pastimes of the Absolute Lord. Such pastimes are of the Lord are very conducive to the hearers for self-realization in the field of devotional service. Right. So looking at that, we're inspired with the thought that, again, you know, he desires to lie down. And all we can think of is just sometimes, like, again, you know, some people like to play in the mud or something. You know, you see, in sports where it has some mud and people do wrestling in the mud or greased pig chasing or something. You know, catch the greased piggy, you know. So it seems that somehow or other, you know, Vishnu has this. Part of it, of course, is the lila to reclaim the living entities. And that's, of course, his satisfaction. And his foremost quality is his mercy on reclaiming living entities out of this whole thing, like that and so on. So, but somehow or other, for him, it is also a lila, you know, play. And how he's involved in it, at first place, is free will. There's no karma, there's no time. And after that, his knowledge is increasing. And you might say every time after they do an incarnation, you know, Krishna and Balaram will look it over and decide, you know, how to improve the whole process. And then they empower Maya to make illusion even more complicated. As we understand, when she created Agasura, it was such an amazing product, you know, that even Krishna was amazed for a moment. What a Maya! What an illusion you've done! And so she was very proud of herself. Oh my God, he likes my demon, you know. So she is all things competition, play, you know, from Krishna's point of view. And very fun and very, very endearing and very profound from his point of view, like that, you know. And if we hear about, you know, Mahavishnu and his activities, it says it's very conducive for self-realization in the field of devotional service. So we visited, for example, one time we visited a monastery in Northern California, Greek Orthodox. It was out in the country, you know, Northern California out there. They had some nice property. They were growing, you know, a lot of their own materials, and they had young men, you know, with long beards, and old men with long beards. And during lunch, they read from the lives of the saints, and it was pretty much, of course, Shantaras, you know, and liberation from this world, and experiencing the glory of God, and also some things like His mercy and things within this world, you know. So hearing about these things in Mahavishnu. Very important for us, you know, for me at least, you know, because I'm still very much, you know, associating with myself as being this body, you know, and if I can keep this body in the mode of goodness, if I can keep it as a proper part of the Varat-Rup, then it's very, very easy for me to, you know, see my higher nature and stimulate that. And of course, as that wakes up, you know, then it's so much easier than to automatically just, you know, relate to the lower nature. So, such pastimes of the Lord are very conducive to the hearers for self-realization in the field of devotional service. So let's go then to the next slide, which is number 7. Okay. Prabhupada says, some may argue, why not then relish the transcendental lila of the Lord as exhibited in the land of Mathura and Vrindavan, which are sweeter than anything in this world, in the world. Vishnu Chakravarti replies that the pastimes of the Lord in Vrindavan are meant to be relished by advanced devotees of the Lord. Neophyte devotees who misunderstand such supreme transcendental activities of the Lord, and therefore the Lord's pastimes in the material sphere related to creation, maintenance, and destruction are verily relishable by the prakriti or mundane devotees of the Lord. Okay. Let's go ahead here. Number 8. Next slide. As the yoga system, mainly based on material exercises, is meant for the person who is too much attached to the bodily concept of existence, similarly, the Lord's pastimes related to the creation and destruction of the material world are for those who are too materially attached. For such mundane creatures, the functions of the body and the functions of the cosmic world through physical laws in relationship with the Lord are also therefore included in understanding the lawmaker, the supreme personality of Godhead. And on top of this, on the slide, we had this comment about Sir Isaac Newton, which I think we'll see later on like that. But he had this very, very much, it was in whatever this is, this is maybe the 16th, 17th century? 16th or 17th, maybe 17th century, 16th, 17th century. Very much there was this interest of understanding how the material nature, it manifests and teaches us the glories of God. and whatever things were there during the Age of Reason, the Renaissance, you know, they were, many people were working to show how they helped us to appreciate God more rather than taking us away from Him. So let's go on to slide number 9. Okay. Then Prabhupada says, the scientists explain the material functions by so many technological terms of material law, but such blind scientists forget the lawmaker. Srimad Bhagavatam points out the lawmaker. One should not be amazed by the mechanical arrangement of a complicated engine or dynamo, but one should praise the engineer who creates such a wonderful working machine. So on the slide, if you can see it, we found this picture of Albert Einstein with his kind of like Sai Baba type haircut. And I think it's Pauli. There's somebody right there. And this was, a slide from University of California in Berkeley a long time ago. Einstein was a visiting lecturer. And behind him, you see on the blackboard, there's like two parallel blackboards, and each one of those has a blackboard which slides up and down, you know. And so complicated formulas, one after another, you know. And now, if you go to the University of California at Berkeley for quite some time, they have a big engineering science building there. And from the outside, you know, because the Berkeley campus is a little hilly. So from the outside, you look at it, it's like this, the beginning of a big, round area. And you go inside, and you there, and it's a thrust seating, you know, like a theater. And back row is maybe like one story, you know, above where the actual presentation area is. And the presentation area is something like maybe 50 feet wide, 50 feet wide, the blackboard and the table. And hanging in space, All over the auditorium are different television screens, you know. And so, you know, Chemistry 1A is there, and the man is showing something with all these chemical apparati set up with his things on the blackboard. And, of course, now, you know, projection of all the different ideas. And Chemistry 1A finishes off, and all the students trudge out. And then Physics 1A starts. And the guy pushes the button up in the control room, and the entire front of the auditorium starts to rotate. And the entire 50-foot-long, you know, projection space and laboratory space just kind of rotates out, and the entire other thing rotates in with all the experiments set up and everything else like that, with complicated mathematics and chemical equations and everything else. You know, so complicated to look at the laws like that. So one says that the scientists explain the material functions by so many technological terms of material law, but such blind scientists forget the lawmaker. Okay, yeah. So I'm going to talk about it a little bit more. Next slide. Then number 10, Prabhupada's purport, he goes on here. That is the difference between the devotee and the non-devotee. Devotees are always full with praising the Lord who directs the physical laws. In the Bhagavad Gita 9.10, the direction of the Lord upon material nature is described as follows. Mayadhyakshena prakriti suyate sa characharam hetu nanena konteya jagad vipari vartate. The material nature, full of physical laws, is one of my different energies. Therefore, it is neither independent nor blind. Because I am transcendentally all-powerful, simply by my glancing over material nature, the physical laws of nature work so wonderfully. The actions and reactions of the physical laws work on that account. Unless the material world is created, maintained, and annihilated. Created, maintained, and annihilated again and again. So there's so many Maybe we can look at it, civilization rises up and then something happens. There's a political disturbance or a great natural catastrophe, or the axis is shift, And so many indications, from historical evidence, that people in past civilizations had very sophisticated knowledge of the laws of material nature, astronomy, mechanics, so many things. And in our recent time, of course, the Romans, actually there's some nice movies on architecture in the Roman culture, looking at the whole Roman civilization from beginning to end in terms of architecture. And they developed some pretty sophisticated mathematics, some pretty robust, architectural feats with domes and other things. And, of course, this was lost, And then rediscovered during the Renaissance, and then Newton gave some laws. He did some laws which would enable us to describe mechanical forces, optical forces, and then gravity. He discovered certain things. And somebody else discovered laws regulating the intensity of electricity and different magnetic fields. And then I think it was Maxwell who was able to match up electrical energy with magnetic energy. And so like that, he's discovering different laws, the law of gravity and things like that. But here Krishna is saying that his nature. His nature, these laws exist. And where do they come from? So this is our, more specific endeavor here. We've been trying to work on Carl Jung and his history. And it's very nice because looking into this, Kant in the West was one of the first people who really said, of course back to Plato, other people too, but Kant was really saying that there has to be a subconscious, there has to be a self, behind the adiabatic person who allows us to see this world. For example, he came up with very simple things like causality, that I hit the ball with a croquet mallet and the ball goes and hits another ball and makes that one move. So just from examining the world externally, there's no indication of that, you might say. But the idea of causality then allows us to look at the world and then put things into a connected relationship, mechanical things. So he at least was coming to that point. And this is what, by just speculation and things like this, trying to understand what's happening behind all this thing, you see in the West is such an effort that people having some experiences, some experiments, some experiences, and then trying to put these together into in the philosophy of who we are, what is this world now, how it is working, and why we're miserable, why people go crazy, which is one of the biggest problems in this world. They go crazy and have wars, they go crazy and, they can't manage their own bowel movements and everything else. Okay, so Krishna is saying that he's the cause of all these laws and rules. Behind them, he's there. Let's go ahead and number 11. Men with a poor fund of knowledge, however, become astonished by studying the physical laws, both within the construction of the individual body and within the cosmic manifestation. Yeah. It's interesting, usually Nitai Gaur Sundardas and myself, we go for a walk every evening, most evenings, and it has a certain route we take, and it takes about 44 minutes, and it's just incredible. Because you would think, like, walking that distance, you might be sometimes 48, sometimes 40. If it comes back for almost 44 and a half minutes. So here we have the laws, the laws, the internal laws, And so, his good wife or something, she can look at the clock and see when we go off and see what time she's going to have dinner ready, down to the minute, And then we notice when it gets colder, we walk faster. And so it drops down to 2 minutes. So now we can come up with a law. The duration of our walk is equal to 44 minutes minus times the temperature, times some constant divided by the temperature. And as the temperature increases, then you can subtract this other number like that. And even that seems to be a constant depending on how cold we are. So the yogis and so on, they discover these internal laws in the body, you know, and externally also the cosmic manifestation. We find laws of time, you know, especially time, every place else happening. And then different elements, you know, chemical elements, analysis of different elements, physical elements. Foolishly, they decry the existence of God, you know, taking it for granted that the physical laws are independent, without any metaphysical control. The Bhagavad Gita 9.11 replies to this foolishness in the following words: Avajananti mamuda manushim tanum ashritam param bhavam ajanato mamabhuta maheshvaram. The foolish men, mudha, do not know the personality of Godhead in his eternal form of bliss and knowledge. Okay, next slide, number 12. Yeah. The foolish man thinks of the transcendental body of the Lord as something like his own, and therefore he cannot think of the unlimited controlling power of the Lord, who is not visible in the acting of the physical laws. The Lord is, however, visible to the naked eyes of people in general when he descends himself by his own personal potency. Lord Krishna incarnated himself as he is and played very wonderful parts as the Lord himself, and the Bhagavad Gita concerns such wonderful actions and knowledge. Number 13. Yet foolish men will not accept Lord Krishna as the Supreme Lord. Generally, they consider the infinitesimal and the infinite features of the Lord because they themselves are unable to become either the infinitesimal or the infinite. But they should know that the infinite and the infinitesimal sizes of the Lord are not his highest glories. The most wonderful manifestation of the Lord's power is exhibited when the infinite Lord becomes visible to our eyes as one of us. So that's it. Krishna's personal features are what really, you know, really, you know, make the changes in life. The big things, the cosmic stellar galaxy or subatomic particles. Okay, maybe there's something there. There's some relationship. How they're doing things. We can make atomic bombs and things like this. But the real things are Krishna's personal relationships, you know, cleanliness, truthfulness, austerity, mercy, humor, you know, constancy in relationships. Yeah. Then let's go to slide number 14, big purport. His activities are different from those of the finite beings. Yeah. Lifting a mountain at the age of 7 years old and marrying 16,000 wives in the prime of his youth are some of the examples of his infinite energy. But the mudhas, after seeing them or hearing about them, decry them as legendary and take the Lord as one of them. They cannot understand the Lord Sri Krishna, although in the form of a human being, by his own potency, is still the Supreme Lord with full potency as a Supreme Controller. Near the side of a picture of Gopal with his hand resting on his chin, looking deceivingly like a little child, young boy. Yeah. Okay. Slide number 15. And on our right-hand side, we have our good friend here, Mudha. And if you know, Mudha has a sika. Our donkey has a sika sticking up there. And he likes to hear. He's got very big ears. But also he has a... he got some kind of echo going there. Also he has big nostrils and big eyes. However, when the Mudhas give submissive and oral reception to the messages of the Lord, as in the Srimad Bhagavad Gita the Srimad Bhagavatam through the channel of disciplic succession, such mudhas become devotees of the Lord by the grace of his pure devotees. Okay, let's go on down then to the last slide in this purport. Number 16. What happened here? Yeah, there we go. Yeah. My goodness. Hare Krishna. I'm also losing control. There we go. Okay. And then number 16, last slide in the purport, Prabhupada says, and for this reason only, either in the Bhagavad Gita or in the Srimad Bhagavatam, the pastimes of the Lord in the material world are delineated for the benefit of those men with a poor fund of knowledge. And so this is kind of then one of the tasks that Prabhupada very much wanted to do. You know, was of course the Bhakti Vedanta Institute and preaching to the scientists and explaining things, you know, in terms of the world where people live, in terms of, you know, ecology and health and stuff like that. Hariji gave such nice example, you know, of all the ecology principles. And this is something which touches people very much in terms of diet, health, in the relationships to animals, all within our practical human range of doing things, you know, of taking care of the earth ourselves and cultivating our own food. And then the Virat Rupa explanation, it talks about the elements, and from that you can go to, like, Gandharva, Veda, music, and give very, very sophisticated explanation of music, sound, and the results it has on one's life. You know, different kinds of music are good for the morning, different kinds of music are good for different events, you know. And you can go to architecture and how these influence things, how the village should be adjusted, you know. Ayurveda, then how to deal with the different elements in terms of the digestive system. You know, so much very practical, simple knowledge, which is all human scale. And not only is it human scale, but it's village, you know, village scale. All this knowledge is meant to work with a village-based life, you know, where you know everybody, you live in a neighborhood, you know, very, very simple and practical. But, of course, modern science has become so impersonal, and Prabhupada said because they can't appreciate that God is a simple person, you know, therefore they try to find the absolute truth in the biggest or the smallest. And so therefore you see all the effort is to go to, you know, particle physics, atomic physics, and look at the different crystals and try and manufacture different metal alloys and understand the properties of those to produce, you know, more dense memories for our telephones and, you know, so many things like that, like very much impersonal, you know, very small or very big, or beyond the range of sense perception. And we start using manipulating radio waves and electromagnetic waves, you know, to a large degree. And we build up a world which is basically very, like, inhuman. That's the word. One lady, she was a scientist, and she was giving a presentation about the Gaia hypothesis. And she was saying that her mentor, her, you know, real guide in becoming a biologist, was one rather famous biologist. And she said it always struck her that he said that biology is supposed to be the science of life. That's what it means, biology, the science of life. But nobody kills more living entities than biologists. So it's a very bizarre world. Not even inhuman, but it's opposed to the life of animals, it's opposed to the life of plants, and the only thing is the conservation of atoms, you know, which is concerns them. Other than that, everybody else can be, you know, recycled. You know? So then you go to the next slide, number 17. We tossed a few things in here from our my God, crash. Yeah. Numbers, wait, come on, going down there. Okay. Yeah. So we have a picture of Bhakti Sarup Damodar Maharaj. And, of course, he's our sannyas guru. And we were so fortunate to be able to work with him for such a long time. And Prabhupada was inspiring him, other people too, you know, Sariputta, Dhrutakarma, Rabindra Swarup, other people, they all worked on this project, and Prabhupada promoted it very much. And I couldn't directly relate to it because I had the same excuse as Rabindra Swarup, that the actual scientific mentality was so dry as far as I was concerned. I started in the hard sciences and changed to biology and changed electrical, to change to psychology and graduated, you know. So, but I felt, okay, Prabhupada wants this science preaching at that time, as his number one preaching program. Okay, I've heard that from many sources. So finally I surrendered. Okay, this is it. And then I began to find, you know, how I could fit into it, you know. For example, because I had been through hard sciences, life sciences, and the psychology, the subtle sciences, I was the only person who could index, you know, some of our books, because our books then dealt with many, many different fields. And I had enough knowledge to understand what they were talking about generally, and, you know, cross-culturally like that. So like that, another example, Prabhupada told Srup Damodar, here he is with the Dalai Lama, that one formula is to have very, very nice reception. Even on the street, you receive people very nicely, you compliment them for their clothes or smile at them or something. You know? But with the Bhaktivedanta Institute, you might invite people to a very, very nice building in a nice part of town, and they would come in for some evening program with their wife, and some very, very nice young lady would pick their hat and coat and receive them very, very nicely, respectfully, and say, well, the other delegates are in by the fire, and they'd go in and talk, and they would find people from their peer group there and have some nice entertaining discussions and like that, some drinks, and then very nice prasad. And then after that, discuss philosophy. And that was what he showed Maharaj several times. You know, nice reception, nice prasad, and then philosophy. And people can appreciate after that, you know. So many, many nice programs, nice preaching areas, formally in this area. Of course, informally, we can do it all so many ways. The one where Maharaj is here in the suit, it says, study of consciousness within science. And that was 1990? I can't remember. But that was the whole seminar, which two Nobel laureates came to that one, two Nobel laureates. And it was the first conference on the study of consciousness within science. Later on, the University of Arizona called theirs the first one, but then the BI guys challenged them, and they said, oh, some small things like that. And they showed them all the people that were involved, and they admitted, oh, we didn't know about this. Okay, yes, yours was definitely the first. And I remember, it was so terrible for me. It was so boring. Oh. But I was helping, you know, and it did a lot of good work for them, helped them. And then Rasaraj wanted to reward me, you know, for the work. So I was able to, I was the doorkeeper, you know, for one of the sessions. There I didn't speak, you know. And I remember one of the topics, and I mentioned this before, I guess by the time I dial, I'll still remember this. One of the topics was consciousness one of the array, was consciousness one of the elements of the array of the state vector at the origin of the universe? That's one of the topics. My God. Okay. So somehow or other we went on and we had lunch. And they all loved the lunch. They all loved prasad and everything else. And they loved actually the discussions too. Move on to the next slide. And here we have this book, Life Comes from Life. And Bhakti Srup Damodar Maharaj is a young man with his tape recorder and playing the devil's advocate many times with Prabhupada, you know, to try and discuss the broad perspective on these things. Because once the broad perspective is there in the different sciences, then devotees who are, you know, more technicians, they can take those things and then fill in the technical details, you know, to reach different audiences like that. Physicists, chemists, you know, psychologists. Okay, next slide. Now these are slides from Gopal Hari, Radhika's brother. He was doing his PhD on science and religion at Oxford. And so he was going to travel in South America with his mother and his father with me. And he asked, what can I do? And so I suggested what you should do is present a thing about Sir Isaac Newton, and the second apple. With the first apple, Isaac Newton discovered gravity. It fell on his head. Aha! The second apple was his theology. And he wrote much more about theology than he did about physical sciences. So in contrast, here we have the Mudha scientists. Carl Sagan says on this slide, the cosmos is all that is, or ever was, or ever will be. Okay. Next slide. Next time we have Richard Dawkins, who's actually the biggest biologist at Oxford and one of the biggest proponents of material science. The universe that we observe, he says, has precisely the properties we should expect if there is, at bottom, no design, no purpose, no evil, and no good, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. Thank you, Richard. Okay, let's move on to the next slide here. And now we have Steven Weinberg. The more the universe seems comprehensible, the more it also seems pointless. And in some ways, that these people, this is such a hellish consciousness. How are you going to avoid drinking or something else like that? Move on, next slide. Okay. So here we have these are from a slideshow we did about maybe 5 years ago. But it's still going on. But at that time, there was a raging war between Richard Dawkins, who's the head biologist at Oxford, and a brilliant person. But he discovered many wonderful things. And on the opposite side, Alistair McGrath, who at that time was the head theologian, who historically was the head scholar, because theology historically was the same thing. So, next slide, where are we? Somewhere here, 23. So Dawkins wrote a book called The God Delusion. And then McGrath came back with a rebuttal called The Dawkins Delusion, like that. And he was very British, very polite, everything else. And you can see that a lot of the arguments he has and he used and were very effective were exactly the ones that have gone into society from us. They didn't have these arguments before. They came in, and he limited himself exactly as Prabhupada said, to not going beyond the Paramatma. And he said, I'm only going to talk about the necessity of a creator and a controller in this world. I'm not going to talk about higher relationships to God or anything else, although they're very wonderful, he said. And his book successfully takes Dawkins apart piece by piece like that. So this battle was going on. Let's go down here, next slide. And here we have slide number 24? Yeah. One very, very good book, if you're interested in this, it's very readable. It's called Quantum Questions by Ken Wilber. It was published quite some time ago, but what it is, with a research assistant, he went through and extracted the philosophical writings of, practically speaking, all the founders of modern physics, de Broglie, James Jean, Einstein, Schrodinger, Heisenberg, all Pauli, all these people. It's a very, very wonderful work. And there's a picture of him. He's kind of like a real kind of Buddhist type fellow. He's still an active person. But to this level that we're talking about, we can use his work very nicely. So it's one very good book. It's available on Amazon. So go down here, next slide. And here are a few extracts. Of course, starting with Albert Einstein. This is Quantum Questions, Ken Wilber, Shambhala Books, 1984. Albert Einstein, The Ethical Dimension. The scientific method can teach us nothing else beyond how facts are related to and conditioned by each other. The aspiration toward such objective knowledge belongs to the highest of which man is capable. And you will certainly not suspect me, Albert Einstein, of wishing to belittle the achievements and the heroic efforts of man in this sphere. Yet, it is equally clear, that knowledge of what is does not open the door directly to knowledge of what should be. Or to summarize Albert Einstein here, science can tell us how things are, but it cannot tell us how they should be. Very, very powerful point. Okay, so that's the ethical dimension. Then Einstein goes on, and we call this intuition and motivation. He goes on to say, this knowledge of objective truth as such is wonderful, but it is so little capable of acting as a guide that it cannot prove even the justification and the value of the aspiration toward that very knowledge of truth. Here we face, therefore, the limits of the purely rational conception of our existence. Heavy, huh? This pulls the basis right out of, puts it in perfect perspective. It's very useful, but it's very limited in the way it's designed. Okay, next slide. And we have Prince Louis de Broglie, Intuition and Motivation, again. His picture. He also has an Albert Einstein haircut. Interesting. The great epoch-making discoveries of the history of science. Think, for example, of that of universal gravitation, he says, have been sudden lightning flashes, making us perceive in one single glance a harmony up until then unsuspected. And it is to have, from time to time, the divine joy of discovering such harmonies that pure science works without sparing its toil or seeking for profit. Yeah. Okay, de Broglie. Let's move to the next slide here. Who else we got? Yeah, he goes on. In the last chapter of his great work, The Two Sources of Morality, Henry Bergson, having reached almost the end of his book, and make a note here, Bergson got the Nobel Prize for something, and in his day he was one of the most popular. You know, his books were going into reprint like anything else like that. You know? So one of his things is called the Two Sources of Morality and Religion. Having reached almost the end of his book, he showed to us a humanity in the formidable grip of mechanism, and as if succumbing under the weight of the discoveries and inventions which the creative ability of its mind had been able to realize. Bergson rightly says, quote, now this is de Broglie quoting Bergson, machines which move on petrol, coal, hydroelectric power, and which convert into motion the potential energies accumulated for millions of years have given to our organisms so vast an extension and so formidable a power, so disproportionate to its dimensions and strength, that surely it had never been foreseen in the plan of the structure of the species. Okay, next slide. And, wishing to make us appreciate the essential point, de Broglie goes on, and the disquieting side of the problem, he adds, now, in this excessively enlarged body, the spirit remains what it was, too small to fill it, too feeble to direct it. Now this increased body awaits a supplement of the soul. Now the mechanism demands a mysticism. So we've used this as a title for some of these science lectures, and it's very attractive, very potent. You know, the mechanism requires a mysticism. Yeah. Finally, de Broglie says, the work finishes on these words, pregnant with meaning. Humanity groans, half-crushed under the weight. Humanity groans, half-crushed under the weight of the advances that it has made. It does not know sufficiently that its future depends on itself. It is for it, above all, to make up its mind if it wishes to continue to live. Wow. Good book. So next one. Let's skip over Carl Planck here. Very nice one. And go ahead to, time's running out, to Heisenberg. And Heisenberg was maybe the most rational of all the Nobel laureates. And Pauli, Wolfgang Pauli, so Heisenberg wrote a book called, this is slide number 30. He wrote a book called Wolfgang Pauli's Philosophical Outlook. And he says, from early in his career, Pauli had followed the road of skepticism based on rationalism right to the end. He then tried to trace out those elements of the cognitive process that preceded a rational understanding in depth. So this is it. He tried it out. He did the actual Bahunam Jamanam Ante Yenavam Prapajante. And he came to the conclusion that behind the rational processes, there had to be other processes which allowed us to continue with those. And he actually was going mad, going nuts. And it came out later that his guru, who helped him go through that, was Carl Jung. Yes. A little bit of a confidential thing, because he was in therapy with Jung for, maybe 100 hours. And Jung was guiding him in these introspective processes using dreams and that kind of things. And he then began, at one point, Jung refused to do analysis with him. And he said, if I tell you, I can tell you what your dreams mean and everything else, but unless you discover it for yourself, you're not going to believe me, you know. And so he said, I'll have one of my students, a lady, be your analyst. You write everything down about the dreams, what you think they mean, how the processes work in your mind. And he told her, all I want you to do, and she was terrified, this guy's a Nobel laureate, I'm just starting my whole process. He said, what you have to do is just listen. And if you don't understand something, ask him to explain it. And every now and again, just indicate by saying yes, uh-huh, mm-hmm, that you're following like that, you know. And so he said Pauli picked up very quickly on what he was doing. He was such an intelligent person. Having a woman listen, he said, obviously created this whole feeling of humanity in him and everything else. And allowing him to do the work himself, with her just kind of guiding and making a little bit of advice, allowed him to go through the work himself and not feeling like somebody's forcing me or guiding me. So that's how he gradually came to this point that, yes, there is like a substrate of consciousness behind the external world. And many times that's all you can get these people to understand. Okay, now we'll finish off with our last two slides here. Sir Arthur Eddington. Einstein said there were... Somebody said... Professor Einstein, I've heard that there are only three people in the world who can understand your philosophy of relativity, your theory of relativity. And Einstein is supposed to have said, well, it's myself, Eddington, and who's the third? So he was very close, associated in many ways of Einstein, and also in his own right, also very published and respected scientist, ahead of his department. So he was a very strong theological person. So he says, from Quantum Questions, what is the truth about ourselves? What is the truth about ourselves? Various answers suggest themselves. We are a bit of stellar matter gone wrong. We are a bit of stellar matter gone wrong. We are physical machinery, puppets that strut and talk and laugh and die as the hand of time pulls the strings from behind. But there is one inescapable answer. We are that which asks the question. Whatever else there may be in our natures, responsibility towards truth is one of its attributes. This side of our nature is aloof from the scrutiny of the physicists. I do not think it is sufficiently covered by admitting a mental aspect of our being. It has to do with conscience rather than consciousness. So very, very good metaphysical perspective on this point again. And almost the same as Einstein, you know, that there's something behind this all. And atato brahma jignasa. After we go through all these things, bahunam jamanam ting, and we start then we discover that we have this serious potential to know the big questions, and that's an undeniable aspect of our nature. And so then we have to go ahead and do it. It's there. Where does it come from? And our last slide for today, next one, Sir Arthur Eddington, slide number 32. He says, the materialist who is convinced that all phenomena arise from electrons and quanta and the like, controlled by mathematical formula, must presumably hold the belief that his wife is a rather elaborate differential equation. Okay, but he is probably tactful enough not to obtrude this opinion in domestic life. If this kind of scientific dissection is felt to be inadequate and irrelevant in ordinary personal relationships, it is surely out of place in the most personal relationship of all, of that of the human soul through the divine spirit. So this book is a very, very nice book, and very interesting. And of course, I've extracted out some stuff. There are other quotes from Eddington. Eddington has some very wonderful things like that. But in general, yes, there's a lot of resources, and it's increasing. Devotees are doing more and more work, more and more research work. Other people also, basically inspired by Prabhupada in many ways. You know, the preaching is going out, and people take different attitudes because it's going out. And scientific preaching then begins to start, you know, developing this whole perspective that the scientists themselves are changing. They're changing, you know, in many ways. But then what's needed now is that the theologically inclined people, the Christians in our area, or the Muslims in other areas, they need to have good inspiration to find the limits and the resources available in their traditions. And so Radhika is heading off for a Christian Vaishnava dialogue, which is being organized in India. But we have something to offer, and this thing is how to get there and show them we're not trying to destroy science. We're not trying to destroy Christianity or Islam. We're appreciating them, maybe more than you are, and trying to direct you to the resources that you have and how these can all fit in nicely. And then, yes, do science, but do it with this perspective to show people the glories of God and convince them to chant their rounds. Okay. So, Prabhupada ki jai. Hare Krishna Maha Mantra ki jai. Any questions, comments, complaints? Any scientists out there want to chop me up?
Okay, a little devil's advocate. It's just really further discussion. It seems to make perfect sense that there's got to be some intelligence behind all of this, cause and reason, etc. That's the only conclusion that one can really come to, or certainly the most logical. But why the anthropomorphic quality that we have to ascribe to whatever the supreme is? Why does it have to look like man, or why does it even have to have form for that matter? Why can't it just be consciousness in the sky?
Okay, this is very interesting. So Prabhupada says, by introspection, by logic, by reason, by guided, you know, Socratic view, you can appreciate Brahman. There is a reality. Yeah, okay. And you can also appreciate Paramatma, that there is like order, organization, details, laws, and there is somebody's hand, you know, kind of fooling around with it. He said, but you can come to that level to realize in the Paramatma feature. Okay. But he said the last one of Ananda, which involves impersonal relationships, he said that that cannot be revealed, cannot be understood without descending knowledge. So this is our point, you know. And we're not trying to like artificially. When you come to the point and you judge the person you're talking with is completely rational, completely sane, honest, then if you're willing to accept what he says, you can judge it like the Kumaras. The Kumaras, they came to this point of Shuddhasattva, and when they smelled the Tulsi leaves and the feet of Krishna, then they realized that the absolute truth is full of personal variety. And the personal variety we see in this world is just a reflection of the personal variety we see in that world. That's the basic perspective on it, I would say.
animal.
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
Vyakya Maharaj, just maybe.
Yeah.
Okay. Dandavats Maharaj.
Well, same to you.
So, you know, I found one part of the purport very interesting. The way Prabhupada translated my addiction to Prakriti, the material nature full of physical laws is one of my different energies, therefore it is neither independent nor blind. So, you know, he's directing the wanderings, and also there's some, you know, matter. The material world is not false. You know, we don't subscribe to that, because the material energy is coming from Krishna. And although matter itself is dead, per se, it's animated, you know, not only by the jivas, but there's this direction, these laws, and it's very interesting. So then, are we to understand that the personality of Maya Devi is animating the material nature, you know, as the servant of the Supreme Lord? Is that fair? You know, she's applying the physical.
What we'll see is that that's the whole thing. Is that now in this canto, there'll be some description of how it works. Then again, Maitreya will explain it to Vidura how it works. And then Kapila will explain to his mother how it works. And I think that's pretty much, after that, we go ahead to the fifth canto. Again, there's also Virat Rupa again, the forest of material enjoyment. But that level, it starts to become more, you know, much more, different aspects are covered different times. So in the beginning, the elements will be described in this sense, sound, touch, taste, form. And it's describing that in the beginning there's pradan, which is the non-manifested form. It's like a piece of cloth, you know. But when you cut that and do everything else and put your hand into it, okay, then a puppet comes out and has form, it talks, plays, this kind of stuff. So that's the paramatma. Kapila says that he expands himself, he enters into the material world as Garbhadakshay Vishnu, who is the paramatma of the universe. Just like this body has one soul, which makes it alive. So Garbhadakshay Vishnu is what gives life to the universe. And then Kshiradakshay Vishnu is what gives life to every individual manifestation like that. And so Kapila says to his mother, externally, people who are oriented externally and only can see externally with ego, they see me as time. You know? But those who look internally, they see me as the Paramatma. So the external Paramatma is the time, is the external manifestation of the Paramatma. So as we have a relationship with time, that's our relationship with the Paramatma. If you've got time to kill, then your Paramatma relationship, not very pleasant for him. You know? It's the same way that other people then have different Shiva. Brahma has the potency to create. You know, Vishnu, as a Paramatma, maintains everything. And then Shiva has the potency to destroy it. And of course, Durga is his consort, his Shakti. So she pretty much, you know, they're pretty much related to it on that level of destruction. But, you know, Shiva is also described as being partly with the Paramatma manifestation like that. But that's my understanding. You know, she's mostly working with Shiva, and mostly the point of view of destroying demons and other things, and in the end, the final destruction altogether.
Okay. Nice. You know, Bhagavad Gita, it's said that Srimad Bhagavatam is the postgraduate Bhagavad Gita. It seems like for beginners, neophytes, as it's mentioned in the purport, it's probably more, because it's so broadly accepted, you know, both by the impersonalists and the personalists. Just like the verse that's quoted here in Maya Jakshana Prakriti, that it's a nice way to introduce someone to how the material nature is, you know, there's intelligence and there's some direction and there's some laws connected with that. Whereas you get into Bhagavatam and you get into the, like this purport or the description of the creation, and unless someone has, just as Vishwanath saying, we shouldn't rush to the Vrindavan pastimes, you know, you won't understand a Prakriti unless you have a foundation, you know. But the Prakriti Bhaktas, the devotees that are not very advanced, they're still very much entangled here. They can appreciate the creation pastimes, but even they are a little more along than someone who has no conception of the Vedas, no understanding of anything. So it seems like the lead would be Bhagavad Gita, and then the imagery of the, you know, Mahavishnu to Garbhadaksha Vishnu to Shiradaksha Vishnu, all this, you know, that wouldn't be something that somebody that just stone cold knew would, you know, totally sign off on. You know, that it's just exotic, you know. Whereas in principle, the Bhagavad Gita, you know, Krishna's talking in principle. You know, he's a controller. And everything's being controlled or directed.
Yeah, that's why the point about, we have, as we become more and more purified and knowledgeable, for example, like an ambulance attendant or somebody else, you or I, we can maybe do a little first aid, keep a person breathing, and for maybe just a few, you know, maybe like 15 minutes, 10 minutes. In that time, the ambulance guys show up, they put a tube down the guy's throat, our throat, and do this and that, and they can keep the guy alive maybe 20 minutes to get to the hospital. And as soon as they get him, they roll him right into the operating room, open it up. And so there's like, you know, citizen first aid, you know, paramedic first aid, intern on the table. Next day, a full doctor to do full surgery, and then ship him off to a specialist, you know. And so as we become more purified and more advanced, I think we can analyze people and figure out where they're at. Like one Nobel laureate candidate we met in South America, Umberto Maturana, and very nice guy, very intelligent. He came to this Jung lecture, and he brought about 5-6 people with him, you know. And then he wanted to talk to us the next day, so he wanted us to bring our friends. So very intelligent. We had a whole, basically, it was an interaction between two communities. And I could see it was a much more intelligent way for everybody to figure out what's going on. And his level of comprehension was basically like Hiranyagarbha, a little bit above Virat Roop and a little bit below Paramatma. And so he was ready for that and that kind of discussion. But the other stuff, yeah, you say it was just like it was too freaky for him. It was interesting and that kind of stuff. And okay, I'm impressed. But let's what I can understand really, okay. And so yeah, I agree. You got to figure out what level, because some people, you know, their level is prasadam tastes good. Yeah, okay. Yeah, have a pakora bob, you know, like some chutney. Okay. But other people are in different levels, and so that's the whole thing. As we become more expert, we can diagnose them and then understand what kind of discussion that they need, you know, to advance. You know. Mataji or something you said?
Yeah, hold on,
though.
Actually, why the law? This laws, the energy which came from Krishna, and why we are giving the importance to the law, and is this Vedic is deep with the law?
Oh, your voice is being clipped. I can't understand. I can't understand your voice exactly. The connection is not.
I couldn't able to type because some error.
Ah, okay. So, the devotee's typing? I'm not online here. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna.
I hear you.
Hare Krishna.
Yeah.
I hear you, Maharaj.
The devotee's typing a question or something. I can't see the screen.
Hare Krishna.
Anna, yeah. Mataji, could you type it in? Mataji, can you type it?
Yes, I am typing in the... Actually, there is some error in this. So I'm just typing to the Ramanatha Prabhu by Skype.
Oh, I don't know if Skype's working today. Try to ask you a question. We'll try to understand it. Try to keep it simple.
Yeah. You were asking why people accept the laws but not the lawmaker? Was that the question?
Yes.
That's it?
Yeah, yes.
Okay. Well, because for there's this one Pidayananda Maharaj made this one joke. They say that I won't name the religion, but it's one recent religion or something, and it says that these people are looking for God, but they hope they don't find Him. Yeah, so it's very interesting to look for God. It's fun. You read different scriptures and this and that. One Jewish scholar here. He told us that very, very prominent amongst all Jewish traditions is the idea that, yes, God is a person, but He's so great that we can never catch up with Him. And so we can see His footprints, but we're never going to get any closer than that, you know, so on. Because if we go beyond the king's laws and actually meet the king, then we have to surrender more. The laws, we can say, okay, I'm following this law, I'm following that law. You know, now I can do what I want to do. Yeah. But in a personal relationship, then we have to be more involved and surrender more. So that's why, you know, there are different reasons. Some people, they had a very, very bad taste of God as a person, you know, being presented in a bad way, you know. And that's what Einstein didn't like. But other people, they don't want to. Impersonalists, because accepting the laws allows them to manipulate the material nature and get what they want to get. And then God is a person, they have to surrender more. You know? But actually, when we do that, of course, then we also become more of people. We surrender to Krishna more. Our personal qualities come out more. Is it okay?
Yeah, Hare Krishna, thanks.
Okay. So maybe it's 11:20. Maybe we should stop here. 11:20 here. And,
thank you, Maharaj.
Yeah, go on with your morning program, and I hope everybody, you can kick on the material scientist with a boot. Subhadamanas made that point that whenever Prabhupada said that, there was always laughter. It says, quote, laughter. That Prabhupada never intended this to preach like that. But to animate the troops, he said, kick on their face with a boot. Hobnailed boot. Okay. But Prabhupada never did it. He was always very polite with people. Okay, Hare Krishna, thank you very much for your association.
Hare
Krishna. Nice class, Maharaj.
Ah, well, I hope it works.
Hare Krishna.